Fort Reno, Nevada, to Emma Shaw's way of thinking, was the drain trap beneath Earth's toilet. At least the same sort of thing accumulated there. A cold wind blew out of the mountains, and she snapped up the collar of her bomber jacket. Marie Hayes and Ward Aldridge flanked her. As they turned the corner, a little boy ran up to them.
Hey, want some sex?
He took a step back from them, and the sandwich screen image on his chest was more easily visible.
What you like?
And then he looked at Marie. He touched one of the buttons on the console carried on a plastic belt at his waist, just beneath the screen, and the image flickered. There were two women, one Chinese and the other white. They were naked except for studded black leather dog collars, and they were going at each other as if there were no tomorrow.
Can women really do that to one another?
The boy pushed another button. At least his sandwich screens had something for every taste. The subject this time was a black woman, evidently to appeal to Ward, and she was having sex with a machine. There were machine sex shops all over Port Reno, of course, and all over the civilized world as well. The machines themselves were bisexual, one end fitted with a realistic-looking dildo and the other with a realistic-looking vaginal-like opening. They were pneumatic and could keep going longer than their customers could, as long as enough coins of whatever realm were deposited to keep the power turned on.
Get lost, little guy.
The boy shrugged his skinny shoulders and walked off. The backside of the sandwich screen showed a different program. Quick cuts of something that looked like a Roman orgy, with titles superimposed for the name of the ranch. These in English, Russian, Chinese, and German, the four principal languages. There was even a roadmap showing how to get to the establishment. Emma dug her hands into her jacket pockets and walked on. Along the strip, the boy with his sandwich screens blended in with at least half a dozen other kids of similar size and age and in the same racket. People were everywhere, a good percentage of them prostitutes of every description, including women in male drag and men in female drag. The casinos were lit up so brightly that it was almost possible to forget it was night.
All nude review. There you go. I'm gone.
Ward stopped walking, just staring up at the video marquee. Emma Shaw had to admit the girls looked beautiful. She looked at Ward Aldridge.
So why are you waiting?
Hey, I just don't know if I should leave.
Do unescorted ladies defend for themselves?
Ward shrugged his big shoulders and grinned good-naturedly.
Two unescorted United States Armed Forces officers. I'm a Marine like you, remember? I can look after Emma, seeing she's only Navy. So what's your problem?
Emma was more compassionate to Ward Aldridge's moral dilemma and his male ego.
Look, Ward, we've all got beepers, and even if we wanted to, regs say we can't hit this port unless we're armed. So we're fine. But if you get into trouble, just hit your beeper and we'll bail you out, okay?
His black skin looked almost purple under the neon lights.
I mean it. You guys be careful, okay?
Emma took a step back and placed her right hand over her heart.
Honest Injun, Ward. Marie and I were on the way to the public library anyway.
No public library here, girl.
Then he was gone, lost in the crowd. Emma took her hands out of her pockets and rubbed them together.
So, Marie, which way to the library?
Yeah, right. How about some food? Then we can figure out what we want to do.
So long as it's not Chinese. Around here, God knows what you'd be eating in the chop suey.
Oh, amen.
Emma spotted a flashing neon sign, smaller than most of the others, but its message struck a peculiarly respondent note in her heart.
Pizza!
Together, they ran across the strip, dodging the electric cars and the horse carriages. John Rourke gradually increased the pressure against the bullpup-actioned assault rifle's unsatisfactory single trigger. As he had suspected, the sights were a little off. He had planned a headshot, but instead the man went down clutching his neck. The burst of gunfire that tore into the rocks and snow a few inches from Rourke's face was either the act of a decent marksman or dumb luck. Rourke wouldn't gamble on the latter. He laid down suppressive fire, keeping the two men at bay. One of them ran from cover. The man grabbed for his animal and put the pistol to its head. The beast crashed down, and the man dropped behind it for cover. The two survivors had a modest crossfire position now, and if they eventually got the range right, Rourke might find himself in trouble. He sprayed out the rest of the assault rifle's magazine, the dead horse's body bouncing with the multiple impacts, some of the bullets getting through fat and tissue, however. The man behind the horse seemed to stand upright for a split second, then fell back. One man remained. John Rourke loaded a fresh magazine up the well, then brought his weapon back online. Torches the men carried smoked and sizzled in the snow. Several of the horses had run off, but three of them remained, meandering about the fire zone as if nothing were happening. The last man was up, darting out from the rocks behind which he'd hidden to one of the horses. There was a decision to make. If Rourke shot the horse, he could easily shoot the man. But the horse had nothing to do with the problems between John Rourke and this man he had never met. Life was precious. John Rourke waited, keeping the scope settled on where he hoped the man would be. The horse was still between Rourke and his target. This was taking too long. Rourke made a decision, swung the muzzle of his rifle, and fired. Bullets tearing into the snow and rocks, inches away from the animal's hind legs. The horse bolted forward. The man fell, sprawling into the snow. Rourke waited. There was no need to consult the Rolex on his wrist. He simply counted off seconds, surveying the bodies through his rifle scope, watching for the slightest sign of movement. After 3 minutes had passed, John Rourke edged back from his perch and stood. He would go down into the little dugout valley and check the men. Any who lived, he would provide whatever emergency treatment circumstances allowed. If none lived, things would go more easily and more quickly. Hopefully, he would find a marginally clean coat or jacket that would provide him some warmth. He started down from the rocks, leaving his mounts where they were. The one good result Emma Shaw could point to from the 5 centuries of warfare that had nearly destroyed the planet was the fact that a peculiar little fish known as the anchovy was apparently extinct. The thought of putting a fish on a pizza was disgusting in the extreme. Shrimp were okay, but not fish. She had read about the practice and seen old video movies in which the fish were actually put on pizzas. According to a boy she'd gone out with while at the Naval Academy, the anchovy was salty tasting. He had been studying ichthyology, so she guessed that somehow his dissertation on the anchovy was valid. This pizza, reasonably good, was also reasonably plain. She'd learned that in ports around the Pacific, one should never eat something unless it was unmistakably identifiable. Hence, this pizza had roast beef and onion over the cheese, along with green peppers. Sausage or ground meat was to be looked at with a jaundiced eye. She drank cola because, although she had shore leave, her unit was on alert.
I don't see any choice. This asshole Martin's a clear-cut aggressor, got a war machine like this planet hasn't seen in over 100 years, and he's basically telling every world leader to go screw. We gotta take him out before he tries taking us out.
There have been lots of tin plate dictators. After a while, they get to be a real problem. But by the time governments figure it out, it's usually too late and the mistake costs a lot of lives.
Martin lives in Eden City, right? So why not put a lot of people into Eden City real fast and hit him? You Navy guys fly us in, hang around for a few hours, maybe take a little target practice on their anti-aircraft installations, stuff like that, then fly us out again. Piece of cake.
Do they teach you guys that? In the Marines, I mean? To have egos like that?
You saying we couldn't do it?
Oh, we could do it, but it's not going to be that easy, Marie. He's got manpower, technology, and no supply problems. Remember, we have to bring the war to him. The terrain's in his favor, too. So many mountains around there, short of nuclear weapons. How do you get somebody who's so well entrenched?
Well, you Navy guys bob in there and dump a lot of conventional explosives.
And what do we respond with when he uses his nuclear weapons and his gas? The same? Why does history have to repeat itself?
Both their beepers went off simultaneously. This sound meant that someone else who was set for the same frequency was trying to make contact. Marie had her beeper out first, switching off the sound and punching up the antenna.
This is Captain Hayes. Come in.
The words that came back were hard to hear with the beeper beside Marie's right ear, but Emma Shaw recognized the voice. It was Ward Aldridge. 2 of the blankets, Eden military surplus, seemed marginally clean. The coats of the dead men were either threadbare or full of holes, in most cases both. John Rourke took the 2 blankets and cut holes through their centers, then pulled them on like ponchos, one over the other. He cinched them around his waist with his gun belt to hold in some warmth. Of the weapons the dead men had carried, none were of decent quality except for 1 rifle. The weapon was old, from the last war, and less than 6 rounds of ammunition for its solitary magazine were on the owner's body. Rourke left the weapons, freed the horses, and led his own mounts up along the ridge to a point where it flattened out a little and there was less danger of a slip. He swung up into the saddle on the little mare. Both animals were rested now, and while he'd tethered them during his attack on his pursuers, he'd put on their feed bags as well. Nothing would compensate for the cold and the duration of the ride, but under the circumstances, the animals were fit enough. John Rourke started north again. Emma Shaw kept her slice of pizza in her left hand so she could get to her gun with her right as she walked beside Marie Hayes, trying not to look hurried, back across the street that divided the strip, toward the place with the all-nude review where Ward Aldridge had gone and was now looking at potentially serious trouble. The intel people, rumor had it, believed that Eden had groups of terrorists working as part of a worldwide network, their mission to disrupt and destabilize through as violent a means as possible. There were prominent people being assassinated all over the Allied world. There were robberies, bombings, and the occasional kidnapping for ransom. A group of guys who had Eden Defense Forces written all over them had drifted into the strip joint over the last 45 minutes, and according to Ward Aldridge, looked to be heavily armed. Everyone in the Wildlands who could afford to buy a weapon traveled armed, and those who could not afford to made one. Those who went weaponless often paid a high price. Emma Shaw and Marie Hayes reached the other side of the street, Emma's eyes moving along the curb, looking for signs that something was about to go down. Aside from a couple of military surplus internal combustion vehicles parked on the opposite side of the street from the strip joint, there was nothing out of the ordinary. Internal combustion vehicles were common enough in the Wildlands, where population density was light and electric recharge stations might be few and far between. Even with a poor miles per gallon ratio, something in the 50s or so, enough synth fuel could be carried to cross the width of the continent from one of the farthest points west, like Port Reno, to New Charleston on the east coast. In another time and another place, the logical thing for Ward Aldridge to have done would have been to call the local police with his suspicions. But many places in the Wildlands had no law enforcement at all because there was no law. Port Reno had cops, but they were worse than any criminal could be. A mixture of ex-Eden Defense Forces personnel and other men, probably some of them one-time land pirates. They enforced the edicts of the casino and skin parlor owners, not any sort of law. Like a small private mercenary army, they worked solely on behalf of their employers. And the trouble was, again, according to Allied intelligence, the Port Reno Constabulary might well be in league with the Eden-backed terrorists. As a free port of call with the largest airport facilities west of the Rift Valley, Port Reno was transfer point for almost everyone traveling from one point on the globe to another. Two burly men, obviously armed with large energy pistols slung to their bodies, stepped into the doorway as Emma and Marie started inside.
If you come into hook, gotta see.
Emma looked at the one who had spoken, a 6 foot or so Chinese with a shaved head and rippling muscles under his Hawaiian-style shirt.
Look at me, big man. What's this uniform insignia read? Commander, United States Navy. See that?
The Chinese stepped away, and Emma and Marie passed by him and the second door guard into the strip joint. Ordinary logic would have dictated that when Ward Aldridge realized there was the potential for trouble, he'd have walked out. Emma had always respected Ward's judgment ever since she'd first met him as an upperclassman at the academy, and his judgment was not in question here. As they passed through the doorway and into the club, she saw the reason Ward had called them on their beepers rather than walked out. There were at least 36 servicemen in the bar, enlisted men who were, by Port Reno regulation, unarmed. Since Eden forces and Allied forces used the port, the Port Reno businessmen had decreed that no uniformed personnel could be armed while in the city. United States regulations dictated that all commissioned officers be armed at all times, so the enlisted men and women traveled weaponless, and the officers broke the Port Reno regulations by order, trying to watch out for the enlisted personnel. A good 75% of the people on the club's floor were male. Nude dancers performed on a carousel stage that slowly revolved into and out of view, some obvious hookers, and the nearly nude waitresses representing the female side. Emma felt out of place, not to mention looking it. Her outfit consisting of medium heel low quarters, nylons, khaki A-line skirt, khaki uniform shirt, her A2 jacket, and her hat. The hat, a classic cloth envelope that dated back to World War I and looked stupid on nearly everyone who wore it, especially a woman, was tucked into her uniform belt. Marie, who had a peculiar fondness for hats, wore hers, with her hair piled on top of her head beneath it, just like a girl out of a World War II movie. Except for the nude dancers, some of whom wore feathers, and the waitresses, who wore skimpy transparent halter tops and bikini bottoms, the rest of the women were dressed in the current fashion. In the magazine, it was called Neo 60s. The look took three routes. There was the basic look that just meant that skirts were way shorter and sometimes a funny hat was added, or instead of a dress at all, a skin-tight jumpsuit was worn. Emma liked those. Then there was the sweetheart look, which meant that even with with the short skirts, the attire was overall very lacy and frilly. Lastly, there was the really avant-garde. This latter style made all the women who wore it look like hookers, at least to Emma Shaw's way of thinking. Their outfits consisted of micro-mini skirts, usually of a fabric made to resemble leather, textured stockings, and thigh-top high-heeled boots. All this with a skimpy top and lots of junk jewelry made the amateurs awfully hard to distinguish from the professionals. Most of the other women she saw here were into micro-minis and boots, and if her first assumption that they were hookers was incorrect, they certainly dressed the part. Emma followed Marie toward one of the two long bars. The bars were set in an acute angle, forming an apex-less triangle, the entrance itself where the apex would have been. The revolving stage formed the base. The dance floor, together with ridiculously small round tables, filled the area within the triangle, with loud disco music blaring from speakers the size of small aircraft. Anyone who sat at either one could see the show on the revolving stage, either by swiveling around on his stool or by looking over each respective bar into the system of mirrors behind and above the bar. Ward Aldridge occupied a stool by the entrance on the right-hand side. He must have been watching the two women approaching in the mirrors.
Buy you ladies a cola?
Sure! Hey, our kidneys are up for it.
Emma sat down beside him on the right, Marie taking the stool on his left. Ward Aldridge didn't have to point out the men he thought appeared suspicious. Emma Shaw was already spotting them herself. It amused her to consider that she was probably the only service person in the place, aside from Marie, who wasn't staring raptly at the stage. As she worked her eyes over the bars and the table area, searching for the questionable patrons of the type Ward Aldridge was worried over, she saw servicemen, mostly Marines and some sailors, all of them unarmed if they abided by regs. Not to do so could mean disciplinary action. If an Eden terror squad were planning a hit on the place, it wouldn't be the first time that American servicemen were their victims. There had been an incident in Rio de Janeiro on the South American Atlantic coast 3 weeks ago in which 15 Allied service personnel, Americans from Midwake and Hawaii, and Germans, were killed and 43 others wounded. Although Eden disavowed the action, even condemning it at the Geneva talks that seemed to always be going on, Eden terrorists had to have been responsible. She was a fan of the great detective novels of the 20th century, and the terrorist act in Rio fit the Eden M.O. perfectly.
So what do we do, big guy?
If we start something and I'm wrong, we've created a diplomatic incident with Eden. If I knew what to do, I'd be doing it, Emma.
Emma Shaw nodded, thinking.
How about the shore patrol?
Same thing. Our boys go into action, diplomatic incident time. But we can't just sit here.
Wait a minute.
There was a permanent shore patrol station at the harbor. All the spots along the strip had the number and could reach the station instantly in the event Allied service personnel started trouble. It was just standard procedure.
If the shore patrol is called in by us, it's a diplomatic incident, maybe. If the club management calls in the shore patrol, it's another story.
Ward just looked at her, then started to smile. Emma bowed her head and batted her eyelashes.
Thank you very much.
Then she slipped off her bar stool and started walking along the length of the bar toward the end nearest the stage. There were a half dozen Russian merchant seamen at that end, and although Russia was a member of the Transglobal Alliance and a good friend of the United States on an official level, there was no love lost between U.S. and Russian personnel at the personal level. She stopped in front of the largest of the six Russian seamen, turned, and slapped him in the face.
You son of a bitch! You can't talk to a woman like that!
The man looked at her dumbfounded.
What is wrong with you, Commander?
From the edges of her peripheral vision, she could see some of the U.S. service personnel starting to turn around and stare, some of them even standing.
Look, Ivan, maybe you can talk that way to your own woman, but you can't talk that way to an American girl. Put him up!
The Russian seaman did what she'd been hoping he'd do since she slapped him the first time. He shoved her. Despite his size, he didn't shove her hard enough to knock her down, but she took the shove as if he had and sent herself sprawling onto the floor.
You beast!
There was a blur of khaki as a U.S. Marine Lance Corporal stepped up and offered her his hand.
Ma'am?
She let him help her up, making herself cry. She'd learned the trick in high school when she went out for drama club.
Don't worry, Commander.
The Lance Corporal turned around to the big Russian and socked him right across the jaw. In the next instant, almost everybody was fighting. The Russians at the bar, the American service personnel, the Port Reno civilians, even some of the hookers.
Shore Patrol's coming! Shore Patrol!
And Emma Shaw knew his reasoning. This way, the GIs would get out and not have to spend the evening in the brig. She looked around and saw Marie crack a synth glass bottle over a civilian's head. Past Marie, near the entrance, she saw several of the military-looking civilians Ward had pegged as Eden terrorists making for the door. She tapped Ward on the shoulder, and he turned around so fast she thought he was going to take a poke at her.
What?
Those guys you thought were terrorists? Let's follow them.
With what?
Desert cab?
And I bet you I know who picks up the tab, right?
Well, it's the gentlemanly thing to do.
Shit! Let's go!
Ward ran for the door, presumably to hail a desert cab. Emma Shaw looked for Marie, but her friend wasn't there.
Marie? Marie!
The fighting was slowing down, most of the GIs running out onto the strip. But there was no sign of Marie. Although she'd probably hit the bricks like everybody else, Emma was getting a funny feeling in the pit of her stomach, and it wasn't from the pizza. She ran toward the door.
Out of the way! Out of the way!
Those servicemen who looked her way at all deferred to her commander's rank and her sex, but most didn't even bother to look. Pushing and shoving, she made her way into the bright lights of the strip and saw Ward Aldridge instantly, almost wrestling one of the half-track desert cabs to a halt in the middle of the street. And then she looked to the other side of the strip, to the two Eden military surplus half-tracks. She saw a flash of khaki being dragged through the fuselage opening just as the drop-down hatch started to raise.
Holy shit! Ward! Ward! They got Marie!
Ward wheeled about toward the two military surplus vehicles and just stood there. Like herself, she guessed, not knowing what to do. But then she knew what to do. She drew her pistol from the shoulder holster under her armpit with her right hand, then fired it three times into the night sky.
Yo, Navy! Marines! The guys in those half-tracks got Captain Marie Hayes in there with them. Get every vehicle you can and block the road! Move it!
The second half-track was still loading, four men running across the strip toward it, brandishing weapons but not firing. Emma Shaw, her pistol in her hand, started to run toward the four Eden terrorists. At the far edge of her peripheral vision, she saw the desert cab Ward Aldridge had flagged down starting to move. She shot a full glance to her left. The cab driver, a woman about Emma's own age, was standing there in the middle of the street, shaking her fist. The cab was aimed right for the still lowered door of the second half-track. Ward Aldridge at the wheel. Desert cabs were used all along the West Coast. They were converted half-tracks, much like the vehicles the Eden terrorists drove, only stripped of the heavier armor and fitted with more comfortable seats. The engines worked over for better top speed. The desert cab Ward drove was coming on fast. Two of the four men racing toward their still unbuttoned half-track spun toward the desert cab. But energy rifles were strictly anti-personnel weapons and next to useless against light armor unless the hits were repeated and concentrated in one spot heavy enough to melt the armor. Ward was zigzagging the desert cab as he drove it toward the men, making it impossible for their fire to penetrate his armor. Emma stopped running and brought her pistol up into a point shoulder position. Now she squeezed the trigger and dropped the nearer of the four Eden terrorists shooting at Ward in the desert cab. Ward ran over a second man involuntarily. Emma Shaw turned her head for an instant, recoiling from the sight. She'd never shot anybody before in her life, but at the moment, putting the lights out on a terrorist hadn't sunk in enough to bother her. But seeing a man turned into a smudge of grease about the same thickness as the pizza she'd just split with Marie Hayes was another thing. As she looked back, the two remaining men were running toward the second vehicle, which was already in motion, its side loading door still open, dragging along the street surface and making a shower of sparks. It was picking up speed. The desert cab Ward Aldridge drove was nearly at top speed. Ward's desert cab drove onto and stopped dead on the ramp-like door. The half-track spun around about 90 degrees and stayed there, Ward's desert cab sitting on its door. The street that bisected the entertainment strip was filling up with vehicles from both directions. More desert cabs, electric cars, and everything else the GIs had been able to put into motion to block the escape of the two half-tracks. But from the direction of the docks, there were shore patrol vehicles coming. Emma started running again, dropping into a crouch beside the man she'd shot, feeling the knee go out in her right stocking as she did. She grabbed up the dead man's energy rifle. She really had killed him. A shiver went up her spine, and there was a slightly sick feeling in her stomach. The energy rifle in her right hand, the 9mm Lancer caseless pistol in her left, she charged toward the first military surplus half-track. It was stopped, too, and the door was opening. She saw some of the men from the bar, and between them she saw Marie Hayes. Marie's hat was gone, and her hair had fallen down. Her jacket was off her shoulders and over her arms, exposing the harness from her shoulder holster.
Back off or we kill the Marine, bitch!
The shore patrol vehicles were stopping, uniformed SPs piling out, bristling with weaponry. An electric staff car pulled up behind the wedge the SP vehicles had made. Emma Shaw recognized the man who got out of it. He was Captain Edmund Ron. Not only the youngest captain in the fleet and the sexiest hunk in the Navy, but the most obnoxiously arrogant and conceited man she'd ever met. He was also her commanding officer. He took off his cap as he passed through the ranks of SPs, running his fingers through his dark, wavy hair.
Shaw! What the hell is going on here?
She couldn't very well come to attention or even salute because she was holding a gun in each hand and they were both leveled at the terrorists.
Sir, we've got a situation here. These men are Eden terrorists. Captain Ulrich, Captain Hayes, and myself discovered them preparing to attack one of the clubs here on the Strip. We started a fight in order to evacuate the building and preempt any enemy action. They took Captain Hayes hostage, sir.
Tell me this is some sort of stunt for a movie, Shaw. And Captain Ulrich is just playing a part. So that desert cab that's having sex with a half-track is just a prop.
No, sir. They really are having... Captain Ulrich used the desert cab to stop the vehicle, sir. The personnel who assisted us in evacuating the club were actually...
Why the hell I gave any of you clowns liberty at Port Reno is beyond me.
You were ordered to, sir, by Admiral of the Fleet, Wilma Hayes, sir.
Captain Ron just looked at her, then glanced over toward the terrorists. Emma looked at them, too. They honestly seemed confused by what was going on, and she didn't blame them much. As she turned her head, her eyes met Captain Ron's.
Well, I can see, Commander Shaw, that as ranking Navy officer on the scene, you had the situation under control. So carry on, Commander.
He turned on his heel and walked off, going to the young Chinese Lieutenant J.G., who'd come up commanding the SPs.
Fong, take your orders from Commander Shaw. Carry on.
She was tempted to stick her tongue out at him, but she didn't. And even though Ward Ulrich was a Marine and had date of commission on her, Emma Shaw was technically the ranking officer. But Emma Shaw didn't quibble.
Mr. Fong, deploy your personnel to surround the enemy vehicles. On the double!
Aye, aye, ma'am! You heard the commander. Move it!
Then she looked back at what was going on. Captain Ron had stuck her with the duty in the event Marie got killed, so she, Emma Shaw, would get the blame. Ward Ulrich was out of his desert cab, crouched behind it, his pistol aimed at no one in particular. She had the con, so she'd use it.
Unarmed personnel, withdraw to the far side of the street. Move it!
The GIs who'd helped stop the enemy vehicle started drifting away as told. She looked at the man who held the full-size energy pistol to Marie Hayes' head.
Back off, bitch, or she gets it, I mean it!
Emma Shaw stooped over and set down the energy rifle. Her pistol in both hands, she raised it slowly, deliberately, to a point shoulder position. Fong's people were fully deployed now, ringing the two vehicles. If a shootout started, aside from Marie getting killed, Ward Ulrich would probably buy a stray bullet too.
If you surrender your hostage and your weapons, you will be turned over to the civilian authorities of Port Reno, which, as we both know, means you'll be able to talk or bribe your way out of trouble. If you do not cooperate, I will assume that your hostage will die anyway. Therefore, I will shoot your ass right now.
She didn't want to remind the terrorists that their hostage was the niece of Fleet Admiral Hayes, of whom they had more than likely heard. That was why she avoided using Marie's name, instead referring to her as the hostage. And more to the point at the moment, since the terrorist spokesman had not yet responded, she didn't want him to realize she was bluffing.
What'll it be? An easy buyout or dead? I don't have all night, fella.
Women's equality had come a long way in 600 years, but there was still the possibility that someone in long hair, a skirt, and heels wasn't quite intimidating enough to make these guys release their hostage and drop their guns. Her father and her brother had taught her that once the guns come out, talk was limited, if not non-existent, so she said nothing else, just kept the muzzle of her gun as steady as she could. The terrorist spokesman, he was 30 or so and had a face that belonged to the psychopathic axe murderer in a horror movie, shoved Marie Hayes away from him. She stood there for a second, shrugging her jacket back up onto her shoulders, but not walking off.
Civilian authorities?
My word as an officer and a lady.
Place him down! Place him down now! Do it! Do it, men!
The man bent over and set his energy pistol on the pavement, then raised his hands over his head. Hesitantly, Marie started walking toward Emma Shaw. The other terrorists started laying down their weapons as well.
Mr. Fong!
Yes, ma'am!
See to it that these individuals are properly disarmed and that they are turned over to the civilian authorities as I promised. Confiscate their weapons and any pertinent documents on their mission. And get them photographed so that we can throw their pretty faces into the computer.
Yes, ma'am!
Marie was nearly even with Emma now, and Emma Shaw started to lower her pistol.
Oh, Emma. I almost pissed in my pantyhose.
Captain Ulrich!
Yes, ma'am!
Please take over here.
Yes, ma'am!
Then Emma Shaw holstered her weapon.
You look kinda green, but maybe it's just the neon lights, huh?
Remember about your pantyhose? Well, I did pee mine.
And she wanted to throw up. She was being called to duty. She could throw up out the window of the car on the way back to the docks. Her damp pantyhose would have to wait a while. The armored personnel carriers hadn't moved for well over an hour and a half. Neither had Paul Rubinstein. But men in Arctic gear were now starting to emerge from the rear doors of both vehicles, heavily armed. Presumably, commanders and technicians were still inside. They would be running sensor scans, Paul theorized, for thermal registers, sound emissions, radar, and the like. And they had to be on to the fact that someone was waiting down in the defile, or they would not have sent men out, but instead would have pursued the hoofprints in the snow leading off and away from the site. But they didn't know exactly where, had no fixed position, for if they had, their vehicles would have been in motion and in pursuit. That they had not pursued the preponderance of hoofprints leading off toward the town, to which the rather curious Marianne had led John and Natalia, was a very bad sign. The scenario was clear to Paul Rubinstein, but he hoped it was not that obvious to the enemy personnel. Either John or Natalia had come back with horses, evidently not even a wagon, judging by the marks in the snow. When whichever one of them it was spotted the armor carriers coming up, some of the horses were cut loose, giving tracks to follow. The other horses were taken into the defile. Paul estimated that at best John or Natalia and those other horses were 500 yards from the enemy personnel who were now fanning out into the snow. Three of these men were clearly land pirates, as evidenced by their garish garb and more basic weaponry, their affiliation obvious. The other six were either Eden Defense Forces or Nazi, and he was beginning to think there was such a faint line separating the two that it was almost non-existent. The six were better uniformed and better armed, and somehow seemed to move with more evident precision and purpose. From what he knew about their vehicles, the standard operating crew consisted of a commander who doubled as backup driver, the driver who doubled as engineer and weapons controller, and the navigator who also operated communications and sensors. That meant that besides the nine men starting toward the defile, there were likely six more, three inside each vehicle. The vehicles themselves possessed a long litany of weapons capabilities, from energy cannons to missiles, and, it was theorized, gas diffusion as well. Their armor, as best he could understand it, was vastly better than the most sophisticated U.S., Soviet, or British armor of the late 20th century. Paul Rubinstein did not like this new world very much. Even after 125 years, the present was too much like the past. Only the players had changed. The world was on a war footing again, and what civilization there was seemed retrograde in the extreme. For the past hour and a half, while his limbs were gradually numbing with the cold, he had been considering his options. There were few. John was a good enough marksman to take on nine heavily armed men with virtually any firearm, and much the same could be said for Natalia, but he was not. With the Steyr-Mannlicher SSG, he would have stood a good chance. With his Schmeisser, if the distance had been half what it was, he might have tried it. But he was close to being out of effective range for the 9mm Parabellums his submachine gun fired. If he'd had an assault rifle, it would have been iffy at best, so sniping was out. Once he started something, whichever one of his friends was down in the defile could be counted on, of course, to assist, but timing might be critical. The only option he had not ruled out was the direct method. That involved getting inside one of the armored personnel carriers and taking it over. There were, after all, nine men outside, but only three men in each of the armored personnel carriers.
What am I doing here?
And then Paul smiled, because he knew the answer to the question. Marianne looked about ready to pass out. Natalia Tyamarovna's fingers were so cold, she wondered if she would be able to successfully operate her weapons. But she lay still, almost motionless. She could hear the sounds of booted feet coming toward her. Her mission was, thus far, a failure. She had a total of six horses, a half dozen blankets, and five coats, these latter taken from the bodies of the men John had killed in the saloon. By now, after all the time that had passed, many of the women freed from the land pirates would be suffering severely from exposure. And it was always possible, with the armored personnel carriers positioned as they were, that Paul and Annie and the freed women would just stumble upon the enemy into a disaster. But she had another thought now. What if Paul and Annie were considerably closer than she had thought? What if even now they too were aware of the enemy vehicles? Did she have an ally out there, perhaps ready to strike? But what could be done? No weapon they possessed would have any effect against the APCs. The modest amount of explosives available would cripple one of the machines, but only if detonated against a tread or detonated from inside. Paul Rubinstein had 1 pound of the latest German plastique, and he had a plan.
It's a planned demonstration.
Manfred Kohl had a blank look on his face.
We cannot get involved.
Men and women, looking for all the world perfectly normal except for their 60s-style mod clothing, Nehru jackets, Mao caps, bell-bottom trousers, miniskirts, boots, were moving through the street, carrying torches and placards. The signs dealt with such standard anti-Semitic propaganda themes as Jewish conspiracies, Jewish financial manipulation, Jewish anti-government sentiment, etc. Moving slowly because of his wounds, but moving nonetheless, Michael Rourke turned off into the side street, flanked by Manfred Kohl and James Darkwood. He had other work this night. The satellite uplink had been made, the message sent, and the business at hand was to get out of Eden City alive so he could fight what grew here, not stay and make some futile gesture, like running up to a demonstrator and pulling the picket sign from his hands and tearing it up, and then die. Eden Defense Force personnel and police were everywhere tonight. As it turned out, Emma Shaw had the time to change her pantyhose anyway. She had been waiting in Captain Edmund Ron's outer office for nearly 10 minutes. At last, his secretary answered an intercom, Emma Shaw could not hear the conversation, hard as she tried, and then looked at her.
Captain Ron will see you now, Commander Shaw.
Thank you, Seaman.
Come in.
Emma walked across the room and came to attention before Captain Ron's desk.
As you are, Commander, take a seat.
Thank you, sir.
After what seemed to her like an eternity, but realistically was only a minute or so, Captain Ron, he was terrific looking, she thought, set down his pen and looked up from the documents he'd been perusing. They were intel printouts. She'd seen enough of them over the years to recognize them at a distance.
I've just received orders from Admiral Hayes personally. By the way, you did well with that mess you caused in Port Reno. I'm willing to forget the incident ever happened.
Thank you, sir.
Admiral Hayes has been in touch with Allied Intelligence HQ. It seems there's an extraction that needs handling just west of the Rift Valley. I assume you're familiar with Dr. John Thomas Rourke?
No disrespect, sir, but who isn't? He is only a god among men.
A few people in the upper echelons have known this for quite some time, but Dr. Rourke, well, he didn't die as the rumors went.
What? I mean, sir?
Dr. Rourke and his near-legendary family, the very same people my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Admiral Ron, worked with 125 years ago, are alive. Or at least they were a little less than 24 hours ago.
But Dr. Rourke and the others would be at least...
No, Commander Shaw, they would not be old. They survived by means of cryogenic sleep. I understand from Admiral Hayes, who has seen Dr. Rourke personally, that he looks like a man in his late 30s. He is physically unchanged from photos taken of him at the conclusion of the war with the Soviet Union. The same goes for his family, with the exception of his wife, who remains in cryogenic sleep, and a German officer who joined them. Dr. Rourke, his son, his daughter and her husband, and the Russian woman who served so valiantly with Dr. Rourke, Major Chemerovna, are all out there. Well, not the son. He is working with Commander James Darkwood, whom I believe you know.
She knew him all right, having graduated with him from the academy. James Darkwood was one of her best friends in the world.
Commander Darkwood, as you may know, is on detached duty to Allied Intelligence. But Dr. Rourke, his daughter, her husband, and Major Chemerovna are on the west side of the Rift Valley. Without extraction, their situation is considered hopeless.
Yes, sir.
This is not something I can order you to do. But if you volunteer and can find a sufficient number of other volunteers to undertake the mission with you, you'll be entirely on your own. We will officially disavow this mission should you be shot down, killed, or captured by the Eden Defense Forces. Aircraft are being readied now. All markings removed, added armament pods installed.
If I get them out, sir, bring them back here?
If you succeed in your mission, Commander, you will return them here to refuel, drop off any wounded, then fly immediately to Pearl Harbor, where you will receive further orders.
Captain Ron had been looking at everything but her face, as was his habit, not just with her, but with everyone when he did a preliminary mission briefing. But now he looked her straight in the eye. His eyes were so powerful she had to blink.
I envy you this opportunity, Commander Shaw. And, should you accept, I caution you that Dr. Rourke still holds the rank of Brigadier General that was conferred upon him at Midway by the President, personally, more than a century ago.
Consider me volunteered, sir.
Captain Edmund Ron stood up. Emma stood up, too. He walked around the desk, extended his right hand to her.
Good luck, Commander.
Thank you, sir.
She turned, starting to leave, and she wondered what she was getting herself into now. As she stepped into the outer office, Captain Ron's secretary handed her a video packet marked Eyes Only. She knew exactly what she was getting herself into, something that would probably turn out to be more trouble than she could imagine. Paul Rubenstein had inched his way through the snow along the north side of the slope until he was within 20 yards of the nearest of the two APCs. Time was running out. At any second, he expected to hear gunfire from the defile, where all nine of the field party had disappeared. The APCs, aside from their standard sensing equipment, were equipped with intruder alert systems. All he had to do was touch one of the units and the system would kick on. In New York City, in the wintertime, he used to get together with his friends occasionally and go out to the park. All of them would pretend they were kids again, which usually meant getting into a snowball fight by the end of things. He'd been a pretty good hand with a snowball, even as a little boy. He pulled off his outer and inner gloves, his hands instantly starting to numb even more than they had been. He kept the gloves under his left upper arm, pressed against his torso to trap the warmth inside as long as he could. As his hands dipped into the snow, there was stinging pain. But he had a proper amount of snow, and it was good packing snow, nice and wet. He formed it into a sphere that, to the naked eye at least, looked as perfectly round as round could be. There was no time to waste because his hands couldn't take the cold much longer. He rose to his feet and launched the snowball toward the rear door of the APC nearest him. Then he ducked, waiting for the hoped-for reaction. As he got his gloves back on, his hands shaking with the cold, the hatch started to open. There would be men waiting just inside, he knew. But he had his Schmeisser to his shoulder, ready, and in his pocket was another ball, this of plastique, about a quarter pound's worth, with a detonator displayed prominently embedded into it. Only the detonator was disabled. He trusted that the intended recipients of the ball of plastique would not realize that. The hatch was halfway down now, about as far as prudent men would lower it. He lowered his weapon, took the ball of German plastique explosives from his pocket, and lobbed it toward the doorway where the opening was. If he missed, he had a second ball prepared. He had learned that from John a long time ago. Plan ahead. But Paul Rubenstein did not miss, the ball of plastique explosives and the neutralized detonator disappearing inside the APC's hatchway. Nothing happened for a second or so. If the men inside were nervy, they'd take a second to inspect the ball, albeit from a distance. If not... The door opened downward all the way, the three men who had been inside now outside, running, pulling coats on and holding weapons at the same time. Paul Rubenstein had the German MP-40 submachine gun back to his shoulder. Then Paul was up, running toward the hatchway of the APC before the turret gun on the second machine could open fire on him. Now, if he could only have enough time to switch detonators. He didn't bother pulling the neutralized detonator, but simply inserted the fresh one, then slapped the ball of plastic explosives against the bulkhead near a row of riveted armor plates. The second ball was already in his hand as he moved forward, and Paul stuck it to the bulkhead near the hydraulic lines for the brakes. He set the timer, and then he started aft, toward the open doorway. The turret gun on the APC beside him turned. Paul jumped from the ramp and into the snow, a bolt from the energy weapon mounted on the second APC's turret just missing him, but a shower of partially vaporized snow falling around him, drenching him. He threw himself beside the tread at the APC's left rear.
9 seconds.
Paul burrowed as deeply as he could into the snow, almost but not quite in contact with the tread.
3.
If he had calculated the strength of the vehicle incorrectly, he would be dead.
2.
Paul Rubenstein's hands were over his ears and his submachine gun was protected beneath his body. And then there was a second explosion, and Paul Rubenstein knew that what he'd done had worked, turning the armored personnel carrier into a gigantic fragmentation bomb to destroy the second identical vehicle. Now all he had to worry about were the 9 men armed and afoot in the defile. Up, moving.
Stay here with the horses. Do as I say, or you will be in trouble.
Natalia ran obliquely along the wall of the defile so she would not run right into the man who searched for her. Whatever had happened, from the sound of the explosions, it had to have affected their vehicles. So they would be returning to the vehicles. Natalia reached the height of the defile, staying just below its crest so she would not silhouette herself against the skyline. The night was bright. She ran into a stand of scrub pine, her short-barreled assault rifle ready, her coat open at the chest, so she could access her suppressor-fitted pistol should the need arise. As she cut through the trees, she saw the rear edge of the party of searchers, counting at least 9 men, running toward a descending fireball and a twisted pile of blackened wreckage. She saw a figure moving from the far side of the wreckage. The only way she could tell it was Paul was because Annie was back in skirts. Natalia flung herself down into the snow, letting the assault rifle fall across her back, her right hand ripping the suppressor-fitted Walther PPKS from the shoulder holster, her right thumb, she had her outer gloves off, flicking up the safety into the fire position. She thumbed back the hammer, both elbows steady on the snowy ground, then starting the trigger squeeze. With any luck, she could take out two of them before they realized where she was shooting from. Natalia had one man down and was squeezing the trigger on the second when a third man, she had him at the edge of her peripheral vision, started to turn around. She let the second man live for a moment longer and swung her pistol to the man who was turning around. Natalia swung her weapon back to her original target. Dropping the safety on the American Walther, she stuffed the longish combination of pistol and suppressor into an outside pocket of her parka. Grabbing for her assault rifle, she rose to her feet and ran back into the trees. Energy pulse impacted a tree about a meter from her, engulfing the trunk with fire, the sapling pine toppling over and nearly falling on her. She dodged right. Paul Rubinstein emerged from the far end of the demolished second APC. John or Natalia was out there, Rubinstein bet with himself. He charged forward, firing into the remaining three men who were running toward where the defile began. Paul caught a flash of movement to his right and wheeled about toward it.
Natalia!
She had the short-barreled assault rifle she carried up to her shoulder. Immediately, especially since he had just destroyed the best transportation they could ask for, the reality of beating the cold before the women died of exposure washed over him like the sounds of the waves crashing in his still-ringing ears. It was nearly dawn, and John Rourke guided the Big Gray to the height of a rise. In the valley below, there was a farmhouse. The coordinates on the map he had memorized, his compass bearings, and a gut feeling told him he had reached the safe house. It was still over a mile away, and there was no sign of a fire from the house's crude stone chimney. If the Allied agents Hilda, Dan, and Margie were not there, at least there should be a radio for making a satellite uplink and contact with Allied intelligence headquarters. But that would take even more time. His hopes rested on the barn. The weathered gray clapboard structure, its roof half collapsed, was big enough to house several vehicles, and the Allied agents had said there would be transportation available for however many personnel he brought out of the land pirate's stronghold with him. He hoped it was there. The night had been long and cold for him, and he knew it had been worse for Paul and Annie and the freed women. Natalia would have long since reached them, and with 10 horses used wisely, they would have made better time and might be close to the town again. Those 7 buildings in the middle of nowhere, where he'd had the gunfight with Marianne's old man and company. He urged his mount ahead.
It's gonna be the best tasting feed you guys ever had, and I'll rub you both down, and you'll be warm, I promise.
John Rourke hoped he was right. Emma Shaw zipped into her flight suit, then slung her shoulder holster into position. The Lancer 2570 A2C was cleaned and freshly loaded. She strapped her knife to the outside of her right calf, a Bowie pattern with a 6-inch blade made from 5/16 stainless stock. Anything longer could have interfered with movement, and the thickness of the stock in conjunction with the short length of the blade made for a combination that was virtually unbreakable in human hands. Emma looked into the mirror, picked up her spare brush, and ran it through her hair several times. Then she caught her hair up almost at the crown of her head with a rubber band which had a bead on either end, winding it around twice so it would stay put under the helmet. It looked really sexy, just to make a toss of the head and pull on the helmet, but when she took it off, she had a head full of knots. This way, with a ponytail to start with, she at least had a fighting chance. She grabbed up her helmet and her flight bag, which had already been checked. A survival kit, spare ammunition for her pistol, marker flares and such were right where they should be, along with a change of underwear and a sweater. She shrugged into her A2, then took a final look at what had been her home for the last 187 days. Maybe she'd be back here, and maybe she wouldn't. But she hoped Marie Hayes or somebody wouldn't be packing up her stuff and sending it back to Honolulu with 2 cops with the same last name of Shaw in the custody of some Lieutenant J.G. in a dress uniform with a note signed by the President of the United States. She loved the American flag, but not enough to wear it. Michael Rourke's body was about at shutdown level by the time the antique V-Stall aircraft settled on the field 50 or so miles south of Eden City. Manfred Kohl, who seemed to be the least happy man Michael Rourke had ever met, looked grim.
You realize that to get under Eden's air defense sensors is very risky, and we might all be killed if they fire a missile at us?
James Darkwood looked at Michael, then at Kohl.
Manfred, you know I like you. You're my best friend in the whole world, right?
This is true.
Right. But why the hell do you have to be so depressing all the time, Manfred? Gee whiz.
James Darkwood then spoke into his radio.
This is Orphan, Fairy Godmother. We're on our way. Acknowledge. Over.
Michael Rourke could barely hear the low-frequency response coming back through Darkwood's radio, but he didn't care. He grabbed up the shotgun-sized grenade launcher he'd been carrying ever since they got into the car to leave Eden. He'd had no intention of being taken alive, and started walking onto the field. Aboard the aircraft, he told himself, he could sleep. There was clear evidence of a fight, that was certain.
Herr Doctor, I tried my best, but the young Rourke, I am afraid, was able to overpower me. One of the main floor guards was found in the alley beside our building. He was given an injection and has not yet been revived by our doctors. But it is safe to assume young Rourke escaped. And I am also afraid that our beloved Martin has fallen into enemy hands.
Dietrich Zimmer looked into Kronberg's eyes. He could not read them, but then Kronberg was an accomplished man, and lying might be one of his accomplishments. John Rourke swung down out of the miserable excuse for a saddle, his tailbone hurting him. He drew both scoremasters from his belt. The door to the farmhouse opened. Her gray eyes scowling, Hilda stepped out so rapidly that John Rourke nearly shot her to death.
I understand that you have Martin. I also have just been notified that the Americans are sending out a group of interceptors to pick you up and then find the rest of your party. It is a pity, really, because I wanted to see Martin.
John Rourke didn't put away his guns, and wouldn't until he saw the inside of the house and made certain everything was as it should be. But he smiled.
If you've seen my face, you've seen Martin Zimmer's face. You got anything hot I can consume after I take care of the horses?
She flew into the sun. The first time she'd been up at the controls of an aircraft, despite the fact that she had a senior pilot instructor with her, the beauty of what she saw struck her. It hadn't left her in all the years since. Aviation was lost to the United States, while she survived only beneath the Pacific at Midway. One of the first, if not the first, citizens of Midway to be aboard an aircraft in five centuries was the heroic Captain Jason Darkwood, later Admiral of the Fleet. Midway's aviation program began in earnest, with the aid of New Germany, in the decade immediately following the conclusion of the war. Almost immediately after, the underground city in the Urals was taken by Dr. Rourke and the Allied armies, and Jason Darkwood led his famous raid against the Soviet undersea complex, the people of Midway began returning to the surface. Some made what later proved to be a colossal error, going to what had been the United States and was now Eden. Almost from the beginning, Eden had become the antithesis of its name, not a paradise, but a boot camp for hell instead. But other citizens of Midway re-established an American presence in the Hawaiian Islands. The islands had changed considerably during the five centuries they were uninhabited. With the global climate change, temperatures ranged from below freezing in the winter to the mid to upper 80s on the Fahrenheit scale during high summer. Topography had changed as well. Hawaii's several volcanoes had been particularly active during those 500 years, and sea levels rose and fell and rose again. No one who had known the islands during the 20th century would have recognized them now. They were still as close to paradise on Earth as man could attain, but of a different sort, less fragile. Orchids still grew, but the snow in the high mountains was so reliably deep that skiing had become one of the island's favorite pastimes. In the 125 years since the end of the war, the United States had once again become a surface power and was now at parity with New Germany in air power. And of course, the United States had the greatest navy in the world. New Germany possessed a token navy at best, but had the second largest standing army, second only to Eden. Australia had a modestly sized but well-respected air force and navy. Eden's navy was small but wonderfully well-equipped. But to think that for centuries, no American had flown was almost incomprehensible to her. To Emma Shaw, flying was as much a part of life as breathing, and the interceptor she flew was the finest aircraft of its type in the world. The interceptor was based on the concept behind the much-revered pre-war SR-71, an aircraft capable of high-altitude flight and ultra-high speed, which was nonetheless enormously handleable. Archaeologists kept finding things all over the world, relics from before the night of the war. If, somehow, an archaeological team ever dug up an SR-71, she'd almost kill to fly it. But the interceptor was better. It could do Mach 7 if it had to, yet had the ability to convert to V-stall operation, so it could land on a postage stamp and take off from the roof of a building. The interceptor had the capacity to carry 12 persons plus a two-man crew, or equivalent cargo weight, and no one quite knew just how high it would fly if pushed. Someday she wanted to do that. Its variable swept wing forward-leading canard design was the ultimate best. To fly a plane in combat, she knew, it was imperative to think of that aircraft as the best there was. But she truly believed it. There was considerable talk of a space program as a cooperative effort between members of the Trans-Global Alliance, but nothing would happen with that until the crisis with Eden was resolved, and Emma grew ever more convinced that would only be resolved with a war. Unlike the SR-71, the Interceptor was a battle plane. The SR-71, according to what she had read, did not carry armament because it outflew its attackers, but missiles flew much faster these days. And, aside from missiles in the weapons pods, there were forward and aft firing electric miniguns. Emma looked to the right and left, her wingmen just where they should be. The volunteers to fly the three aircraft in and extract the Rourke party were just whom she thought they would be, Marie Hayes and Wally Theodore. Wally was out of the academy only 2 years, but was naturally gifted as a flyer. Marie was tops as well. Between the three aircraft, since none had a co-pilot navigator aboard, they could carry 39 passengers and gear. According to the intel tape she'd viewed and the printout she'd seen, there were 24 female prisoners rescued from the hands of the land pirates, John Rourke, his daughter and her husband, Major Temirovna, and an unnamed male prisoner. She wondered if the man were the leader of the land pirates, or perhaps one of the Nazi advisors to the Eden forces. Whoever it was, taking any sort of Eden official prisoner was a political hot potato. And what was the second half of her mission once she got in, made the pickup, and got out? Maybe taking Dr. Rourke to Hawaii or Midwake to meet with Admiral Hayes? Emma Shaw dwelt on the idea of John Rourke. Meeting him was like meeting... she didn't know whom, but perhaps God himself was the closest. He was a living legend, homage to John Rourke and the common language of English, all that the United States and Eden had in common these days. John Rourke's face was on both nations' currency, postage, in every history textbook. Sometimes, being a woman was a pain. Male officers didn't have to worry about pantyhose to go with dress uniforms, artfully arranging hair so it looked in rags, things like that. Yet sometimes, when it came to meeting a man like Dr. General John Thomas Rourke, being a woman was a pure delight. He had to be the sexiest man in human history, or at least she hoped so, because otherwise she'd be terribly disappointed.